Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a highly sought-after consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, celebrity wrangler, and thought leader, I connect innovators and influencers from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to Madison Avenue. And as a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives. I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is David Butler, someone I've wanted to have on the show for quite some time. David brings over 25 years of experience as an investor, advisor, designer, executive, and brand strategist to his current role as VP of Innovation and Entrepreneurship for Coca-Cola. Joining the company as its first global head of design, David successfully led the design-driven turnaround of an $80 million brand, a global brand, obviously, prompting Fast Company to name him a Master of Design and Forbes to elect him to their executive dream team. In his current role, David leads a seed stage venturing platform called Coca-Cola Founders, designed to co-create new high-growth startups by connecting repeat founders with some of Coca-Cola's biggest challenges. In 2015, David co-authored To Design to Grow, How Coca-Cola Learned to Combine Scale and Agility, and How You Can Too, a book that Tim Brown said caused him to rethink IDEO. Welcome to the show, David. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Kelly. It's an honor to be here.
We are equally honored. Now, David, to start things off, having a trusted advisor is so important, and I wonder if you'd be kind enough to share who some of your mentors have been along the way, and if you care to, maybe share how you're helping to mentor others these days yourself.
Yeah, Kelly, I'm a huge fan of advisors. I've had advisors actually across my whole career. I started to say career, but really my life. So every aspect of my life, I try to leverage advisors. So huge fan. And I mean, essentially, that's what I do in my day job all day long. I talk to founders all day long. So I love to advise as well. So yeah, I'm a huge fan.
Excellent. Excellent. So let's dive in about Coca-Cola Founders. What is it, and why and when was it started?
Coca-Cola Founders is the company's seed stage venturing arm. We launched the first iteration of this actually in 2012, and we're on we're now on our third operating model, and I can go more into that. But anyway, we launched in 2012, and the reason why we launched it, that's a great question. I think every big established company is challenged with the things that made them very successful. It's a little bit of a long answer here, but Warren Buffett often talks about his investing strategy. He looks for castles with deep and wide moats around them, meaning strong competitive advantages. And I think that every large company, including Coke, those advantages have gotten them to where they are, but sometimes they can restrict them from exploring new areas. And that's essentially why we created this platform.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And of course, I can relate to it, having spent a good chunk of my career at Apple. And as powerful and successful as Apple is, it's why I wrote the book I did, was to showcase, things that the culture inspired that work really well for a company that other companies could consider emulating, but also some things that do get in the way. And I really relate to what you shared. I mean, Apple and Coke are both huge global icons, and yet, as innovative as they both are, they often get in their own way. And you need
exactly.
Fresh insights to grow and evolve and disrupt.
Exactly.
So it makes a lot of sense that you're doing that. Now, how is Coca-Cola Founders different from a traditional accelerator, whether in-house or out-of-house?
Good question. So I'd answer that. The way they're different, let me talk about corporate accelerators in general. And my corporate accelerators are generally structured almost like a speed dating service, meaning, you get 10, 20, startups coming to pitch to the company, and they partner or work with the company, through office hours and that kind of thing for some fixed time period, let's say 3 to 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of that time, if the established company and the startup connect, then great, that's awesome. But Oftentimes, as you know quite well, that's just not enough time to actually go deep and really collaborate with the corporation. So anyway, that accelerator model, we started off not exploring that model from the beginning. In fact, we wanted to create something new, and we didn't really even know what to call it. That's why we called it Coca-Cola Founders, because we didn't really have a model. But the way it's different is in two ways. Number one, we start off with a big Coca-Cola challenge. And so we're not looking for ideas or solutions to a problem that we have. We're actually looking for founders that want to explore that challenge with us. So that's number one. And number two, we work with repeat founders. We work with founders that are builders and know how to build a company. That's very important because we know a lot about, the business models that we leverage or we operate in and the assets that we have, but, we don't know how to do what they know how to do. So it's very important for us to work with experienced or repeat founders.
And of course, those repeat founders all share a common DNA in that they've had the intangible and the real world experiences, the intangible qualities and real world experiences that are really unique to serial startup founders, to serial entrepreneurs.
Absolutely, and this is where the win-win happens when you can get a serial entrepreneur who's going to create a big disruptive company anyway. If you can connect them, or this is the theory, if you can connect them with a scaled company, a globally scaled company like Coke, we're in 207 countries out of 208. If you can get those two together, what could you create? And that was the thesis. That was the premise for why we started this.
It seems to be very successful. So before launching a startup, the founder is, as I understand it, immersed in the power of Coca-Cola, defined as relationships, resources, reach, and are asked to focus on big problems that lots of people have. David, could you elaborate on some examples of some of these common challenges?
Sure, Kelly. So one of the biggest challenges for Coke and actually any other CPG company out there is what's commonly referred to as out of stocks. And I'm sure you know what that is. But, essentially, if our products aren't on the shelf when you as a consumer want to buy them, right, so the retailer can't sell it, you can't buy it and enjoy whatever it is, and, we don't get any value, obviously, out of it. So, out of stocks is one of the biggest challenges that we have. And, in fact, if you look at our scale, it's a billion-dollar challenge. If you're a founder, you're looking for, a big problem that people have, but also a big market so you can build a high-growth company inside that. So these become, billion-dollar markets essentially for founders to develop inside of.
So it can actually incubate a bunch of unicorns.
Well, that's the hope, I'd say.
I think that is the hope. Now, in less than, 3 years, your team has built a portfolio of 12 such companies in 10 countries. Could you tell us a story about one of them and whether they've succeeded or challenged or failed and what some of their challenges have been?
Sure, and as you know quite well, given that changes every given day, but I'll tell you a general story about one of the portfolio companies called Wonolo, that's W-O-N-O-L-O, and actually this company is based in San Francisco. But the founders started on this this exact problem, this exact challenge we just talked about, out of stocks. And, what they did is they got deep inside the problem. So, in other words, they rode around on trucks with our drivers. They talked to retailers and really got deep inside the problem. And one of the challenges that they found, Kelly, was that I'm stuttering because, this type of a challenge is what actually is often people refer to them as wicked problems. They're interrelated problems. There's multiple problems, intertwined. So there's no one solution, one, silver bullet. So anyway, once they started getting into this challenge, they saw that, one of the challenges inside of out of stocks is this idea of being able to restock the shelf on demand. And
yes.
Simply put, we can't do that. No matter how big you are, you can't be everywhere all the time. And so when you or your friend, takes the last Diet Coke off the shelf, we can't be there to bring it back from the back office to, fill that shelf on demand. And
right.
But they thought, what if you could? What if you could? What if you could do that? And so essentially what they created is the Uber for temporary staffing companies, meaning they have built a platform similar to Uber where they can post a job. And if you want to do the job, you come and, you go to Wonolo and you accept the job and do the job, just like drivers and riders connect through Uber. So
mm-hmm.
they developed Wonolo, and that system, that product, that company is actually helping us restock shelves on demand. So again, as soon as a retailer sees that the shelf is empty or needs to be restocked, post that job. If you're a Winolaer, is what they call it, people who want to do these things, do the jobs, you go on Winolo and accept the job and do it. It's sort of as simple as that.
And
that's,
of course,
Kelly, that's something that we just could not create inside of Coke, right?
No, but I assume, David, that is a scalable solution that extends well beyond Coke on shelves.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of it. So that helps us solve a problem, but it also helps the founders, you know, hopefully create a big, high-growth company. And you mentioned a unicorn, but, you know, create a big company, because many companies, many established companies, you know, have the same problem, obviously.
And for listeners who don't know the term unicorn, it's an insider term in Silicon Valley, meaning billion-dollar-plus companies, of which everybody aspires to have one if you're an entrepreneur. So, but besides the startup experiences of having been a founder, David, what are some of the other qualities you look for in a founder that might be successful in this model?
Yeah, many different things, Kelly. But you know, we've done this again all over the world, so we tend to think about sort of the U.S. or take a U.S. centric view of, you know, the startup community. But this is true from Bangalore to Buenos Aires. So, you know, we really look for two things primarily. Number one, we call them repeat founders, but we really look for people who have been inside of a high growth company. There's just nothing like that experience, and you can't fake it, right? You know, so we really look for people who have been through that.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is we look for builders. You know, this is not theoretical in any sense. we look for people who can, you know, build a team, build a product, raise financing. Really build something. So those are really the two things. When you boil it all down, that's what we look for.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Now, let's segue sideways for a few minutes here, David, and jump back a bit to your design background, if we could. You know, obviously, having the opportunity to have come into Coke and be the VP of Global Design, which I think you did for about 8 years before you took this new role, was a huge opportunity for you. And I come obviously from a design-driven company to a certain extent as well, given Steve Jobs' DNA. What advantages can a company gain by becoming design-driven, in your opinion?
Yeah, first of all, Kelly, I'd love to just sort of drop the whole design lingo, all the designy language up front, because often that stuff gets in the way. So
do that.
You know, yeah. So the way I, you know, talk about it, actually we use this example in the book as well, but the way I like to talk about it, you know, this through an example is really talk about your favorite restaurant. So think about your favorite restaurant and why it's your favorite. Of course, they've got, you know, great food, or you like the food, but they also, you know, must have great service. You know, maybe they walk in and say, you know, "Hi, Kelly," you know, and they know your name. So think about it. So the location, the experience, the menu, all these things, all the details are thought through and are very well designed. And actually, they're so well designed that they all fit together really well. So that's what I mean by a design-driven company. All the details are considered, and they all are designed to fit together really well. That's a design-driven company.
But from a consumer experience perspective, always keeping the customer in mind, right?
Yeah, you know, I can go to the designy language and talk about empathy and, you know, user-centered, all these words, but it's really just putting the needs of the user first, the customer or the consumer first, and that's, you know, designing from that place. But
right.
Again, there's all kinds of theory and everything around that, but it's getting that first and then getting all the details to connect together.
Yeah, I completely agree. The customer has to be at the center of the wheel when you're thinking about this, lingo aside. Now, as somebody who was in this field long before it became popular, David, how did you communicate those advantages to any of the skeptics you might have encountered along your path?
Go ahead.
Just to embellish, you know, why designing from the customer out was so important.
Yeah, you know, again, when I started at Coke, you're right, I did that job or was in that role for about 8 years. And when I started at Coke, I used a lot of examples of other companies, of other industries, Apple, Nike, these companies. And I got a common response back. You know, they said, "Look, we're not a technology company. We're not a shoe company. We're Coke." You know, so I learned right away that I would have to actually build our own language around all of this inside of Coke. And really think about every employee as a designer inside of Coke. So rather than an elite group of people, and I was the head of this elite group of people that were going to change Coke, I really thought about everyone as being a designer, because I truly believe that. We all design things every day. We design meetings. I mean, someone designed this call, this meeting, this show. Someone designed the device that I'm talking to right now. You know, everything around us is designed. We all are just, you know, better at designing certain things than others. So anyway, started to think about everyone inside of Coke as a designer and you know, build a strategy around that to get everyone on board. But essentially, to answer your question, really connecting the value of design with, you know, with the, you know, profit, with what the company was after, you know, which is growth, you know, increased revenues or productivity savings, you know, this kind of thing. So really connecting design to growth was the key. And actually that's what led to the book.
And that's a good segue. I was just about to talk about the book. Again, Design to Grow, How Coca-Cola Learned to Combine Scale and Agility, and How You Can Too. So what prompted you to write the book, and I know you switched your roles inside the company while you were still in the writing process, so I'm curious to hear how that transition affected the story, if it did.
Yeah, actually, the reason why I wrote the book was really to capture what we were doing, and I'd started, I didn't know it was going to be a book at the time, but I started capturing this again, just to, actually a lot of things went into the company's archives and that kind of thing, but you know, this is the first time the company had you know, leveraged design as a strategy, and I just started capturing it. And Linda Tischler, who's a senior editor at Fast Company, approached me to do an article. And so we did that. And just really when we were hanging out doing that article, she said, have you ever thought about doing a long version of this, meaning a book? And I said, yeah, but I mean, I have a pretty strenuous day job. There's no way I could actually even think about doing that. And she offered to do it together. So that's it, just really started from that, you know, and went from there. But to get to what you said, yeah, midway through writing the book, I actually was offered this opportunity to change roles inside of Coke. And, you know, to answer your question, I had a really good grip on how a scaled company, you know, could use design to be more agile. I'd been living that for 8 years and actually before that. You know, starting this platform and changing roles, starting this platform, I was really able to see how, you know, very agile companies, you know, struggled with scale. And that's what every founder, every early stage company struggles with, you know, some way, something connected to scaling their company. And helped, you know, provide the yin and the yang for the book. It was great.
I'll say it's so fortuitous that transition happened.
Exactly.
Book, really. And might as well ask you to sort of dive a little deeper on that, if you wouldn't mind, David. How is designing for scale different from designing for agility, if you were to crack the essence of it?
Sure. Kelly, designing for scale is all about reducing, standardizing, and integrating the pieces of the business together so that it can scale. You know, we often hear this phrase associated with design, less is more. And this is where, you know, really reducing down to the pure essence of the thing so that, in this case, so you can scale it. And this is what, as you know quite well, many founders, many, you know, early-stage companies struggle with. Evernote right now, there's a lot being written about Evernote right now, but they, you know, continuously, you know, their product roadmap, it goes on forever. You know, they continuously release new features and can't actually do, you know, do that, simplify, standardize, and get down to a very integrated thing that can scale. So that's what I mean by, you know, designing for scale. Designing for agility is not the opposite of scale. It's just different. Designing for agility is about understanding in the book, we talk about six and flexible elements of your business. So fixed meaning the things that can never change, the things that make the business or the brand what it is, right?
Culture.
But being able to, exactly, you know, different things like that, exactly. But, you know, the flexible elements are the things that can change and you know, give the company the ability to actually adapt in a fast-changing market.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example. And we go into this in the book, but I use this example. I've used this all around the world, and everyone knows it. So I really talk about Legos. Legos as a metaphor, you know, or as an example of what we mean here. So if you think about it, Legos, the two fixed elements of Legos that haven't changed for 50 years are again, two things. One is that starter set that you got when you were a kid. You know, they haven't changed that for 50 years. You know, it's the five or six colored bricks and it's sort of starter set. The second thing is the way they connect together. Those two things haven't changed about Legos for, you know, for what has changed are the other sets that you can combine with that. So in other words, you can buy, if you're into Harry Potter, you can buy a Harry Potter set. And you can add that to your starter set. And of course, they all connect together and, you know, build whatever, Hogwarts Castle, if you're into that.
Or right.
Into Minecraft, you can do the same thing and so forth.
Star Wars.
The beauty of that, exactly, Star Wars. The beauty of that is when, you know, I don't know if Star Wars will ever go out of fashion, but let's say Harry Potter. If Harry Potter goes out of style, then they can just drop those bricks, but they have the essence of the brand and of the product intact, right? And that gives them the agility, the ability to quickly react and you know, change with their market. So essentially, that's what we've used, that same principle, that design principle across the company, and that's essentially what the book's about.
Yeah, and I do encourage our listeners to get a copy of the book and read it, because David is at the forefront of this kind of thinking. Kind of brings me over to Tim Brown's comment about the book. Obviously, as the head of IDEO, IDEO being iconic and foundational in the world of design thinking. So in your opinion, David, besides it being a great compliment, what did it mean when he said about your book that it causes him to rethink IDEO? And why is that meaningful or significant in itself?
Yeah, you know, Kelly, I know Tim Brown personally, and that is a, you know, when he said that, it was such a compliment. But to be perfectly honest with you, I don't know exactly what he meant by that. I'd love to ask him that. I need to ask him that. But, you know, anyway, but I think if I were to guess, again, I haven't asked him, I need to, but if I were to guess, it's this notion of agility and, you know, designing IDEO, you know, essentially for forever, you know, and really defining what the fixed elements of IDEO that shouldn't change, but then also building in the more flexible elements. But again, I'm just guessing here, but anyway, great compliment.
I agree with you intuitively. I'm almost certain that's what he meant based on what you just, you know, elaborated on a minute ago. I think that's probably a pretty good assumption. Knowing IDEO as well as we both do, I think that's probably accurate. Could you, you know, a book is like a baby, right? I've done a few myself. But could you share maybe one favorite piece of wisdom or insight from the book for our listeners that might have surprised you?
Yeah, sure, Kelly. We throughout the writing of the book, we tried to capture lessons learned. And, you know, I speak a lot and travel a lot. And, you know, a lot of people ask me how they can apply this to their company. And, you know, it's not a one-to-one match, right? I mean, like every person has to, you know, consider their own needs inside their company. But what we decided to do is just share some lessons that we learned along the way. And so one of the lessons that we share in the book, and that one of my favorites to answer your question is, we call it planning backwards. And the reason why I like it is that inside of our company, and I'm sure every other, you know, big company does the same thing, we have a business planning process. In fact, we call it a business planning season. It's so long and arduous. And it's funny. Every, you know, one of the ways that early stage companies are able to move so fast is they don't do that, right? They launch something and then they plan, right?
Right.
That's what we mean by planning backwards. So launching and then planning based on what you learn. And that's something that I think every big company can learn from. And again, that's just one of my favorite lessons learned.
And a lot of small companies for that matter.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Fail fast is really what you're saying, and then retool.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now it gets interesting, David, because these are all the questions you expected, but I'm going to throw one in that you didn't expect, maybe even two.
Sure.
To find out, you and I happen to be super fans of Brent Bourgeois, if not Bourgeois Tag. Bourgeois Tag was a band that came up out of Sacramento, California in the mid-80s, and I had the chance to see them because I was putting myself through school, and I was working with a local band, and they were on the same bill and yada, yada. I had a chance to try to sign them when I was later at a major record label, and I got beat out by Chris Blackwell at Island. But I am so passionate about that group, helmed by Brent Bourgeois, and they've literally been my second favorite band behind the Beatles for the past 30 years. So to come to find out that you're a fan as well. Now, I don't know if you're a fan, David, of the band or just Brent's, but I'd love to have you have us riff on that for a few minutes.
Yeah, no, that, you know, when we first contacted each other, I looked in your podcast and started listening to some of them, and I came across Brent Bourgeois, and I thought, wait, is this the Bourgeois Tag? And honestly, I thought I may be just maybe the only fan, you know, out there. But yeah, no, I was a longtime fan of Bourgeois Tag, and I knew nothing about Brent Bourgeois. And when I listened to the, you know, the thing, I was starstruck. And anyway, it was really cool.
Yeah, I tell you, he had a couple of big solo hits after leaving the band in the early 90s that are fantastic, like Dare to Fall in Love and, you know, One Kiss. I mean, just all kinds of songs that he's just a masterful songwriter and a great performer. And then he pops up on Facebook a couple years ago and started throwing out these little things he was noodling around with, you know, just fragments of new songs. And myself and a couple of other so-called super fans and colleagues of his said, you know, Brent, maybe it's time to put out a new CD. So, you know, a year and a half, I think, ago it was now, he put out a collection, his first in 20 years, a fairly eclectic collection of just these various random songs he'd composed, and to much to the delight of all of us. So I was thrilled to find you as another super fan.
He sounds like such a nice guy, too, just on your podcast, just an intelligent, you know, super cool guy.
A wonderful guy. And if you're really that serious of a Bourgeois Tag fan, I might surprise you and send you. I had a lunch with Lyle Workman in Los Angeles a few months ago, and knowing what a big fan I am, Lyle was the guitarist in the band. He sent me some really rare footage, so, and some songs that I'd never heard before as a special treat that never got released. So if that would be
cool.
Of interest to you, I may just send you over a link or two.
Of course. Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. And the last thing I wanted to ask you about really is, you know, you're obviously an investor, an advisor in a bunch of small startups yourself. I'm gathering separately from the Coca-Cola founders, just one-offs.
Yes. In fact, I'm quite passionate about that. And my wife is a serial entrepreneur. I've got three daughters. Hopefully they will be. So it's, you know, it's more than just a hobby for me. It's
so clearly,
really,
but I mean, that's a lot to juggle, David, with the caliber of the role you've got and all the founders you're working with in-house at Coke. So how do you manage to juggle choosing ventures that you'd like to be an investor and or an advisor of outside the company?
Yeah, first of all, I look for the passion, you know, and you know, there's certain areas that I'm passionate about. And when that aligns, you know, you can, you know, create a, you know, connection with the founder and, you know, you can, it's almost like a secondhand language. You know, you can really talk fast and move through things if you have a shared passion around something. The founder has to feel the same way about you, and that's what leads to a lot of the, you know, advising that I do. But yeah, my wife and I and our family actually, you know, look for different types of companies, or different types of problems that we're interested in or challenges, and then companies inside those. So, yeah, and that's on the personal side.
And somehow you manage to find the time to do that, although I'm guessing you reduce your labor intensity in that department.
Yeah, you know, I'm again a huge system designer, but also lover of systems. So I have different ways of managing time and you know, different systems in place. But I travel quite a bit, use a lot of the time on planes. You know, thankfully, you know, we have every kind of device known to mankind now, so we can catch up different ways. But yeah, for me, it really comes down to one simple thing I do every day, and that's just prioritize the day. So I get up really early, I'm up at 5 every day. And I just prioritize the day, what has to happen today, and that connects back to other priorities I set. So it's important.
Time management is really fascinating for busy people like you and me. But I find if you bookend your morning and your evening rituals, so you know what you're going to do before you go to bed every night, you know what you're going to do first thing in the morning, you don't have to think about it, you're already that much more productive and efficient than most people in the world.
I totally agree. I mean, what you just said, Kelly, is I think so important. If you can reduce the thinking about it, the way you put it, if you don't have to think about it, if you can create systems around many different things in your life that where you don't have to think about it, it just frees up your time, you know.
Well, something tells me your next book is going to be, if we're lucky, is going to be around, you know, how you manage to shrink time and manage time efficiently, because I think a lot of people could benefit from you doing that, and especially the globetrotter that you are. You still manage to get everything done, so it's pretty impressive.
Cool, thanks. Thanks, Kelly.
Yeah, and I just say, before we finish our chat, I like to ask all of my guests one final question, David, and in your case, it might be challenging to answer, but it's really what comes next for you. What is the one project or collaboration you might not have started yet, but you dream about creating as part of your legacy?
Yeah, you know, Kelly, that's a great question. I don't know, I had this strange fascination or maybe obsession with big companies. And you know, I've worked with many, you know, over my career. And I really feel like this model that we're on now, that this way of opening up big companies to collaborate directly with entrepreneurs is something big. You know, I really think we're on the next wave here. And, you know, so I just think we've scratched the surface. But again, if when big companies can interface directly with founders, so, you know, not through, you know, accelerators or VCs, you know, not through that, but just directly, I think, you know, that's something new. And so I'm super happy to be on this. And again, for me, this is, I surf, so I'm a surfer. This is a huge wave, and I just want to be part of that.
Well, you're not only part of it, you're at the forefront of it. You're leading the charge, and I think it's incredibly exciting. Somebody who shares your passion for innovation and disruption. So you've met your match, and I really want to thank you again for making the time to join us on the show, David. Your time is precious, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kelly. It was an honor. Thank you.
Yeah. So, and to my audience, of course, our wonderful loyal listeners, thank you for joining us. We'll hear you again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.